case this morning is Jordan versus Binns.
Good afternoon, Your Honors. I represent the appellants. My name is Amy Queller. I represent the appellants Betty and Ted Jordan. We are here today on an appeal from a defense verdict, a verdict that was entered in favor of Mr. Binns and U.S. Express. This is a motorcycle versus tractor-trailer collision case where the primary issue is fault. This accident occurred or collision occurred on I-70 East in Indianapolis. Mrs. Jordan was operating a motorcycle, and Mr. Binns was driving a U.S. Express tractor trailer. As a result of the collision, Mrs. Jordan lost both of her legs from the knees down. As I said, the central issue in the case is fault. Critical to the jury's consideration of sorting out who was at fault for the collision were two statements that were contained in the troopers, the Indiana State Troopers report. This particular report was previewed to the jury during the defense counsel's opening statement. This particular report had been hotly contested between the parties prior to the beginning of trial, where the Jordans had attempted to keep the report out completely by way of its supplemental motion in limine, except for a few minor observations by the police, the trooper, with respect to the weather, the road condition, that type of thing. The biggest point of contention and the reason why we wanted to keep the trooper's report out of evidence are the two statements contained in the narrative, which you'll find in the appendix. The report begins at page 13. The narrative is on page 14. The first statement is a statement allegedly from Mr. Binns, the truck driver, to the trooper who arrives after Mrs. Jordan has left the scene and within 20 or 25 minutes after the trooper first gets the call. Mr. Binns allegedly...
Ms. Queller, yes. To cut right to a concern I've got is, I understand your arguments about the statement coming in through the trooper's report, but the trooper testified, right?
That's correct, Your Honor. He did.
Objections to his testimony on the subject. Do you agree with that?
I don't agree with that, Your Honor. We did object to the trooper's testimony. If you look back...
But you didn't get a conclusive ruling on that, did you, in the preliminary... motion limiting ruling.
And actually, no, not on the preliminary motion.
So when he comes up at trial, don't you have to preserve that objection by making it contemporaneous with his testimony?
Well, we made the objection, Your Honor, prior to his testimony. We made the objection along with our objection with respect to the introduction of the trooper's report, Kevin Niles' report, and Kevin Niles' anticipated testimony and the trooper's anticipated testimony. Those objections were addressed with the court before those witnesses were put on the stand to offer testimony.
But during trial?
During the jury trial, that is correct. These objections and this discussion with the court was had outside the presence of the jury. And up until that point, we had made numerous objections relating to these particular statements, not necessarily in connection with them appearing in the trooper's report, but statements coming in from various witnesses.
Yeah, and that goes to an even deeper problem I have, is that at the bottom here, the statement of Mrs. Jordan to the truck driver, Benz, is going to come into evidence. There was no objection whatsoever about its admission. So the content of this report and the content of the trooper's testimony would have been cumulative of evidence that you don't dispute is admissible.
We do not dispute that Mrs. Jordan's statement, to the extent that statement actually occurred, that is a statement by a party opponent. I do dispute that it is cumulative. This is a statement that is in the trooper's report, which is twice removed from Mrs. Jordan. Mrs. Jordan, on the other hand,
it's going to be before the jury out of Ben's mouth.
That is correct, Your Honor. It is going to be out of, in fact, I was the attorney who put Ben's on as a witness in my direct, and elicited that testimony. You're absolutely correct, Your Honor. But
how is your client harmed by it coming in those other forms?
The client is harmed because it is coming in not from an opposing party who certainly has an interest in the central issue of the case pertaining to fault. It is coming in from a third party, the trooper, who is not involved in an investigation and who did not speak directly to Mrs. Jordan. And, Your Honor, to go back to the opening statement again, where this report is shown to the jury up on the VEPS system on a large screen and is highlighted by the defense counsel. And when I say highlighted, I mean he draws to the jury their attention to these two statements. At this point, that narrative and that report has not been stipulated to, and it is not part of evidence. The jury at that point becomes predisposed on the central issue of fault.
Why is it? The trial judge given the usual preliminary instruction, what the lawyers say in opening statement is not evidence, and so on?
Correct, Your Honor. He had given that instruction. We believe, nonetheless, that
they would disregard, jurors would have to disregard that.
Presumably, if they follow the instruction,
but doesn't
that
contradict circuit law? I mean, we presume that they follow the instructions, right?
That's correct, Your Honor. With respect to the opening, nonetheless, Your Honor, we believe that this case is analogous to the Lemons case that I cited in my brief, where there is an error that is committed that goes to the crux of the case, which is the primary issue of fault, and such that the error is harmful instead of harmless.
Could we talk before you pursue that further about Mr. Jordan's statements as reported by Binns, by the trooper, and by Niles? All three of them orally testify that Mr. Jordan says the injured Mrs. Jordan said it wasn't the trucker's fault. Mr. Jordan is a party.
Correct.
So although you've argued this, I frankly don't understand why there's anything objectionable about the testimony from Binns, the trooper, and from Niles about what he told them.
Yes, and I'll take those one at a time, Your Honor,
okay.
Because I have a different response with respect to each one. The testimony, Mr. Jordan's alleged statement to the trooper, is not Mr. Jordan's own statement. It is Mr. Jordan saying, my wife said, it is not the trucker's fault, it's mine, essentially quoting
his
statement.
He is saying
from
what
his wife.
He observed and heard. So we've got a hearsay within hearsay problem. Hers is clearly a party admission. Why isn't his a party admission? I don't understand your position on this.
Because, Your Honor, with respect to a statement by a party opponent, it must be a statement of the party or in the party's representative capacity. When Mr.
And his statement as the party is, here's what my wife said. Here's what I saw and observed that's relevant and otherwise admissible.
Well, and just to clarify, he did not see or observe the collision. He arrived after the fact. And, yes, in Mr. Jordan disputes that he ever made that statement. But assuming he did, my analysis is he is making not his own statement. He is repeating a statement of his wife's, such that it is not a statement by a party opponent.
You're turning the hearsay into hearsay problem into a circle, though, that apparently can't be solved. Do you have any case support? We know the Greenwood air crash opinion dealt with a virtually identical issue. Do you have any case support indicating that under these sorts of circumstances, a statement by a party should not be treated as an admission by that party?
No, I don't, Your Honor. But I fall back on the language of the rule itself, which indicates this, if it was Mr. Jordan who said, it's my wife's fault, it's not the trucker's fault. That is Mr. Jordan's own statement.
He did make that kind of statement, didn't he, at the hospital, kind of a concession that it's not the trucker's fault.
Allegedly for Mr. Niles, yes. He did make that statement. And, Your Honor,
he has a true consortium interest here. This is serious.
That is correct.
Serious loss of services.
That is correct, yes. And going back to that statement to Mr. Niles, that would be a statement by a party opponent. That is where he is saying, I think it's my wife's fault, it's not the trucker's fault. To me, there's a difference between that statement and the statement that's being made to the trooper.
Can I ask one thing that's been troubling me about this case? And I'll ask this of the defense counsel as well. I can't understand why anybody would give any real credence to anything supposedly said by a woman who has got to be in agonizing pain and shock immediately after this terrible accident.
Correct.
And moreover, that if the defense asserted that would be very good for the plaintiff. The plaintiff could say, look what they're trying to do here. Pin all this on poor Mrs. Jordan as she's laying there on the pavement. That's a great plaintiff's argument, I think.
Yes. And we actually did make that argument, Your Honor, we did, that while she could not recollect that she made any such statement, we argued that certainly logic dictates that because she's in the middle of the roadway in intense pain.
Mm-hmm.
Unfortunately, we believe the decision concerning fault was preempted, and when that statement was not only repeated to the jury during opening, but it was shown to the jury in black and white in an Indiana State Trooper's report. I believe that lends credence to the defense argument.
The clear line of cross-examination in that case is with the trooper is, she didn't say this to you. All you know is what Mr. Binns, the other driver, told you, right? And the answer has to be yes, that's right. Correct?
Correct. That is correct.
I assume that cross happened or something close to it happened.
That's correct.
But to go back, in essence, to the problem that Judge Tinder was asking about earlier, if we were to disagree with you on the admissibility of Mr. Jordan's report, so that the oral testimony.
The report?
The admissibility by anybody, by the trooper, by the insurance investigator, and by Binns himself about what Mr. Jordan's reported his wife had said while in agony. But we've got, at that point, four distinct reports that are orally admissible. Binns can say what Mrs. Jordan said to him, what Mr. Jordan said to him. The trooper can say what was reported to him, at least by Mr. Jordan, not by Niles, or not by Binns, and what Niles can say what Mr. Jordan told him. So we've got four versions of this statement that come in orally within the hearsay without running into hearsay problems. And so the question is, with all that, how much more prejudice is there to your side from perhaps clearly erroneous admission of the reports and some additional echoes?
I believe there was much more prejudice. I believe, with respect to Mr. Binns, I handled his testimony concerning what Mr. Jordan and what Mrs. Jordan told him at the scene and I'm getting into it, but I handled that by way of showing that he was a biased witness. And
sure.
When you go through his testimony and break it down, you can see that he didn't relay that information to his case investigator, the person that he reported to, and there's some other key facts in the cross-examination that I believe highlighted his bias. And that's just to begin with Mr. Benz, so that I can reserve some time unless the court has a question.
I'm going to hope our presiding judge will give you a little more time because there's another area I have to ask you about.
30 seconds.
Would you concede that there was a fairly substantial scientific defense as well, the centripetal force defense about the movement of the motorcycle?
Concede
5 days to try the case, so there was a lot more than just these statements, I assume.
It did, Your Honor, but I will tell you, we, the plaintiffs, took up the bulk of the time. I believe, and Mr. Langford can correct me if I'm wrong.
Centrifugal force, not centripetal force.
Got it. But I would say no, Your Honor. In fact, I believe
that
the experts canceled
each other out.
I believe that the experts canceled each other out. I truly did believe that.
Summarize any of that in your brief.
That is true, Your Honor. I didn't believe it related primarily to the evidentiary issues that we had highlighted.
Please.
Are there any other?
Anything else?
No, Your Honor. Thank you very much for your time, and we would rely on our briefs. It appears that my time is out completely. Thank you.
Thank you. Mr. Langford?
May it please the court, my name is Michael Langford. I represent Kelly Benz and U.S. Express. I was defense counsel on the trial below and also for the appellees in this case. As your honors know, this case comes down to statements that plaintiff contends are hearsay and should not have come in. But before we even get to those hearsay statements, I want to follow up on the very questions that Judge Tinder was just wrapping up with.
Before you do, I got to say I'm troubled that way you packaged all of this. The admission by poor Mrs. Jordan is going to come into evidence by her statement to your client, Mr. Benz. But then you package it up in the state trooper's report, and display it to the jury, and then you package it again in the Niles report, which incorporates the trooper's report. So you're hammering away with this in ways that highlight this so much. It's really very troubling.
There were several parts to the defense of this case. We'll talk in a moment about some of the science. But as to these statements, if Mrs. Jordan said in response, she said in her deposition, she said it at trial, did you make this statement admitting fault? She says, I don't know one way or the other. And if that's where it ended, I probably would have stepped back from that and just let the information come out and see what the jury wants to do with it. But instead, we had Teddy Jordan, who, as you said, had a very substantial loss of consortium claim, who was at the scene within minutes after the accident, who was at the hospital, spoke to the trooper, spoke to the field adjuster, and also spoke to our truck driver at the scene. And Teddy Jordan was adamant that even though all three of those gentlemen said, Teddy Jordan said this, Teddy Jordan was adamant, I never said it to Litt, I never said it to Niles, and I never said it to Benz. So faced with that, we do need to bring forth evidence that shows that Kelly Benz wasn't making that up. I mean, part of what we're dealing with here is Kelly Benz has information that Mrs. Jordan said it was my fault. The plaintiff's counsel called Kelly Benz in their case in chief and put it out there, this is what you say Mrs. Jordan said. They were suggesting to the jury, and I understand it as a matter of trial strategy, he must be making this up. He's trying to save his own hide. Isn't this outrageous that this gentleman would say this about this poor lady who's laying here? So by providing it in other forms, we are able to say Kelly Benz is not lying.
That's why you're able to get in what the trooper's oral testimony, Benz's oral testimony about what Mr. Jordan said, and Niles' statement about what Mr. Jordan said to him. I don't see how on earth these reports come in.
Well, it comes in through, we'll speak to the police report first, because there's a police report and there's a field adjuster report. The police report comes in much in the way that it came in the In Re Greenwood crash case that Judge Tinder decided back in 1995.
Lying with these district judges. it's not controlling.
Sometimes they're pretty good, though. And in this instance, it was.
But if you recall in that instance, though it was admitted, the proponent of it lost on that motion. I let it in, but they lost the motion.
In a bench trial.
Won the battle but lost the war.
I understand, but the reasoning is right. I mean, the reasoning to get to that point, it's right. The police report comes in because it's a public record under 803A, and it has to have signs of trustworthiness.
Could you address the commentary on 8038? Police reports have generally been excluded except to the extent to which they incorporate firsthand observations of the officer.
And the commentary does say that, mm-hmm. and the commentary further states, as I recall, that you take into account the skill of the officer taking the information. And
officers are legion, holding that you cannot put eyewitness statements in through the police report.
But if it is admissible hearsay that comes in, then as an In Re Greenwood air crash says, that gives a sign of trustworthiness.
The officer can testify about what's said. Let's take, for example, here. Let's suppose we had a different witness on the scene who tells the officer, I saw the whole thing. I was right behind it. The truck changed lanes without signaling, and there was nothing the motorcyclist could do. Could the trooper testify about that statement if that witness does not testify?
Arguably, that would be present sense impression. And so if there is enough...
The report on the scene afterwards to the investigating officer. Are you telling me that comes in?
No, most likely would not.
That should definitely not come in. Does it come in simply because the officer wrote it down in his report?
Certainly not.
Okay, how is this any different?
Admission by a party opponent that gives a level of trustworthiness that's required under 803A that doesn't otherwise exist. And there's one other reason why this evidence comes in that hasn't been mentioned before, and that's excited utterance. We know that Betty Jordan had an excited utterance. I don't think there's any argument from anyone, even including appellant, on that point. Ted Jordan admitted, and there's plenty of evidence in the record about this, that he, too, was in an excited state. He had just seen his wife in this terrible situation on the interstate, and that's when he made his statement to Kelly Benz. Then he's at the hospital, and he says, and I'm quoting him here, he was a nervous wreck because he had just been informed that his wife's legs may have to be amputated. So he has got he's in a startled situation. And that's when he talks to Trooper Litt and also to Mr. Niles, and that's when this information is told. So not only do we have
excited case law and excited utterance when a person is being interviewed by the police officer?
I'm not aware of that. For in and of itself.
Me either.
No, you'd have to look at how close are you to the startling event and how much of the information is related to the startling event. But just because you're being interviewed by the police officers wouldn't by any means in that inquiry. You'd
it
have
seems to
know
me
more.
Not the context for an excited utterance.
Judge Lawrence found that it was. And as we know, I mean, there's abuse of discretion standard is what we're dealing with while addressing these evidentiary questions. And, of course, there's another level here. And Judge Tinder alluded to this, that even if there's a belief that Judge Lawrence abused his discretion allowing these hearsay statements in, the next level of question is, did the erroneous evidentiary decision, did it have a substantial impairment on the outcome of this case? So with respect to this case, you have to ask this. But for these hearsay statements coming in, could the jury have still found as they did? And there was ample evidence. I was not, as defense counsel, going to rest with those
statements. What did you say the standard was?
Abuse of discretion for evidentiary.
But you're asking, was there sufficient evidence to support the verdict?
If there was an error, reversal only happens if there's a substantial likelihood that any evidentiary error affected the outcome of the party.
Thank you. Okay. Mm-hmm.
If I misspoke, I apologize. That's the standard, as I understand it.
Thank you. Mm-hmm.
So the question then is there other evidence that the jury could have relied on, even if we put on the shelf for a moment these statements by Betty Jordan and Ted Jordan? And the answer is absolutely yes. Our brief highlighted that. But we brought in an accident reconstructionist who used the laws of physics and science and did indeed talk about centrifugal forces and whether or not there was any possibility.
Was this a right turn?
It is a sweeping right turn.
Where exactly is it?
It's on Interstate 70. You've just passed the Market Street exit going eastbound before you get to the Keystone exit.
Okay, so this is where the road turns from northbound to eastbound.
Right.
Okay.
It's sort of the opposite side of what's known as the Spaghetti Bowl.
It's the outside of the Spaghetti Bowl.
Right. Okay. So it's a sweeping right turn. There's three lanes. The U.S. Express tractor-trailer unit is in the middle lane. Miss Jordan is riding her Harley Davidson on the inside lane.
Okay,
and why that's relevant in this case is that what happened was there was contact between the vehicles. Mrs. Jordan's Harley Davidson goes down on its side at some point, maybe before contact, maybe after contact, but it goes down on its side. She actually separates from the Harley Davidson, and then the motorcycle does some sliding. There's some blood and flesh on the roadway. These markings on the roadway are photographed and well-documented by the folks at Wolf Technical, the accident reconstructionists. There's also some police photos that are involved. By taking those road marks and then using to-scale Interstate in a to-scale Harley Davidson like she was driving, we are able to work it backwards to show that actually she went over into the middle lane, into our trailer, by just enough for this contact to happen. And the jury was provided all this evidence in detail. The plaintiffs hired a reconstructionist who wanted to argue differently. But the bottom line is the jury is allowed to decide which way they go. There was plenty of evidence. And then we had a motorcycle expert that said the placement of Miss Jordan's motorcycle was not appropriate. She didn't allow enough cushion. And a likely source of this accident is that she sort of got swept up into because she didn't make an appropriate turn on this sweeping curve. And that's what caused the contact to occur. So it's more than just simply saying this case is about admissions of fault. It's got to be a case also about not just admissions of fault, but is there enough evidence to support this jury verdict notwithstanding those admissions of fault?
Why isn't this, in essence, a battle of experts that is the usual draw? Did you get some concession from the plaintiff's expert that this couldn't possibly have happened the way he originally said?
Actually, his testimony was that it's not possible to really reconstruct this accident because there's a lack of physical evidence. Mm-hmm. Our reconstructionists show differently, that you could do it, and you could also calculate the speed. He had the speed of Miss Jordan at 50 to 59 miles per hour.
Mm-hmm.
So ultimately, when this case is boiled down for purposes of appeal, it's a matter of taking a look at the entire evidence and deciding that on the one hand, the hearsay statements were admissible, but even to the extent that there are struggles with some of the evidence that may have come in either through the police report or the field adjuster's report, clearly that's cumulative evidence. And let's speak about cumulative evidence here just for a moment. There is a plethora of Seventh Circuit law that says that if evidence becomes cumulative, it becomes harmless. And the appellants in this instance are trying to turn that law upside down. And they're saying just the opposite, that once evidence becomes too cumulative, then it becomes prejudicial. There was one time recently that this court looked at that very issue, and it's cited in the brief. It's United States versus Zahursky, which is a 2009 decision in which the court looked at this matter. And the court said, in that instance, it was someone who was accused of molestation of a minor, and there were sexually illicit chats, and there was a lot of information that was let in. And the plaintiff, or rather the criminal defendant in that instance, complained that the court allowed too much in, that it became cumulative, and it was prejudicial. And this is really the point here, and Judge Lawrence actually articulated this point down below. He says, of course that evidence is prejudicial. That is the point of a trial, that each side, as zealous advocates, put in prejudicial information, things that help their case and hurts the other case. The question isn't whether it's prejudicial. The question is it unfairly prejudicial? And unfairly prejudicial means that a jury is making a decision based on sympathies and emotions, not based on the evidence. Here, the complaint is that the evidence of admissions of fault, somehow, if it's said more than once or twice but becomes three or four or five times in the case, that becomes unfairly prejudicial. And the law simply doesn't support that point.
I'm concerned, though, about the use of the documents. All of us prefer to find paper that supports particular statements and so on when we're, if we're trying a case. And you used the written recording, the police report, as early as your opening statement. As I've suggested, that may well have been inadmissible. And why doesn't that, in essence, carry a kind of perhaps irrational, perhaps unreasonable, but nevertheless genuine unconscious effect of giving more legitimacy to that hearsay than it deserves, such as the trooper's report about what Mr. Bin said to him that Mrs. Jordan had said, which is obviously hearsay.
Right. Well, I mean, first of all, I guess to a degree we're getting into the minds of a juror what matters more, words or paper. But why does the paper come in this instance? It comes in.
Assume for purposes of argument here that it
sure.
was error to admit the paper.
Okay.
An error to allow you to use it in opening.
Right.
The reason you want to use the paper, right?
Sure. It because it's contemporaneous. You know, testimony at trials 2 years later, paper is recorded at the very time that it's recorded. And it's nice to be able to show that. That this isn't something
because
that's
that
subject
has
to
more,
faulty memories.
Because that has more probative value, right?
Oral
testimony?
It at least is cumulative value, if not more probative. But it helps support. I agree. Paper helps support words. And I agree. And that's one reason to bring in paper. But ultimately, it was the same thing said. And it is cumulative. And cumulative is, at most, harmless error. Thank you.
Thank you, counsel. You'd used up your time, but Judge Tinder pleaded your case, so you have another minute if you'd like.
Thank you, Your Honors. I appreciate that. I'll be very brief. With respect to, I just want to touch on the excited utterance issue with respect to Ted Jordan, and this goes to your question, I believe, Your Honor, Judge Hamilton, that it's important to note in the evidence that Mr. Jordan, there was testimony elicited from Mr. Jordan that when he saw his wife on the pavement, that was upsetting to him. Mind you, the trooper arrives much later. Mrs. Jordan is now gone from the scene. Mr. Jordan is left at the scene trying to figure out what is he going to do with the motorcycle, and at that point in time has this conversation with the trooper. There's no evidence in the record concerning Mr. Jordan's state of mind at the time that he's having a discussion with the trooper or essentially being interviewed by the trooper about what he knows. So I don't believe that does qualify as an excited utterance. The cumulative evidence, Your Honor, I would rely on my briefs where I believe I distinguished the cases relied on by the defendants in terms of these the report being somehow cumulative of Mr. Bin's testimony and of Mrs. Jordan's testimony, and I would rely on those. Thank you for your patience
and
consideration.
Thank you.
Thanks to both counsel. The case will be taken under advisement.